Hello, hello. It's the Peaky Pod.
Poo-pow.
How you doing out there? Are you doing okay? What have you been up to? Last couple of episodes, I just went straight into it, so I thought I'd stop and say hi today. Some of you probably be like, nah, get straight to it. Don't worry, we'll get there. And hopefully it's going to be interesting, especially since this is the third time I've tried to record this because I kept getting all scattered. Well, I'll tell you why later. Maybe. Well, just hopefully this one takes. Also, when I was trying to do this Sunday night, today is Monday, there was a lot of noise and sirens, and I had the window open, and it just got to be a little too ridiculous. Sometimes I don't mind that, and I leave it in, but it was really ridiculous. So let's see. Since the last episode, I have now seen two episodes of House of the Dragon. Are you watching? Apparently, that's the biggest premiere they've ever had. I'm liking it. It's very well done. I'm already into Rhaenyra, you know. She's a little spitfire. I like her. And who doesn't like dragons? If you've watched it, you know, you can hit me up on Twitter, @PodPinky, about that or anything else, actually, you know, just be cool. And we can talk about some stuff. Or how about The Sandman? I keep watching it. I keep watching episodes over and over. Gosh, I hope they get a second season. They won't announce it yet, and it's making me nervous. Do you love it? Are you watching it? Come talk to me. But today, we'll go ahead and get to the episode now. For some of the people who've been following me for a while or who have read some of my early books, I don't think that this subject is going to surprise you too much. Can you hear the papers? Yeah. And you will know why as I get into it. And I would also say I probably used a quote from this guy. I used to put them in the books, the beginning of a book, different sort of quotes from... I'm not going to say it yet. Let's just start out by saying John Polidori was born September 7th, 1795, in London. And he died August 24th, 1821, also in London. He was not quite 26. Who is John Polidori, and why should you care? Well, not only was he a physician, he was a writer. He was the son of Gaetano Polidori, his eldest son. And Gaetano was an Italian politician, possibly exile is what I had read. He was also a scholar because he had come to London and married Anna Marie Pierce, who was an English governess. John had three brothers and four sisters that came after him. Whew! There was some loving, touching, squeezing each other. I hope they were enjoying it. Now, the reason John is important is because, well, you know, first of all, he was part of the Romantic movement of the time of writers, poets. And he could be, and should be, and is by most people, I think, considered to be the creator of vampire genre fiction. That's right. He predates Bram Stoker. And Stoker, in fact, was influenced in some ways by Polidori. But before we get to his story, I want to tell you a little more about John, because for a while he was completely overshadowed by some of his acquaintances and by, I don't know if you want to call it a misunderstanding or if it was malicious, we shall see. So in 1804, he was one of the early students of Ampleforth College, and then by 1810, he was at the University of Edinburgh. He wrote a thesis on sleepwalking and received a degree as a doctor. By August 1st, 1815, he was 19 years old, y'all. And that is a really big deal even back then. Like, holy crap. By 1816, an even bigger deal is that he became personal physician to the one and only Lord Byron, whom you may have heard of. They traveled Europe, and John Murray Publishers offered Polidori £500, probably a shit ton of money back then, to keep a diary, to keep up with the exploits of his travels with Lord Byron. Why? Because, well, George Gordon Byron, 6th Baron Byron to you, was also a poet and a leading figure of the Romantic movement, and considered by many to be one of the greats. Polidori did do the job, by the way, and the diary was edited later by his nephew, William Rossetti. Byron, at one point, rented a villa, Villa Diodati, close to Lake Geneva, approximately May 1816. They had a few other people hang out there, whom you've probably also heard of. And again, but though we'll get to that in a second. But why would anybody pay someone £500 to keep track of Lord Byron, besides the fact that, you know, was he even that famous at the time? Well, yeah, he was infamous, that's for sure. Because it wasn't just his writing. He was also known as quite the cad. He was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. He seduced his way and womanized his way across Europe, okay? At one point, he was totally the drama and announced, "I shall leave England forever!" There were tales of incest between he and his half-sister Augusta. And so, you know, his marriage was on the friggin' rocks. I think I'd read at one point that he wanted to leave sooner, but, you know, earlier on his wife was like, "No! You won't fucking leave here, you asshole." So, yeah. Quite the infamous company, so that's why they paid for it. Now you got it? Now, the people who stayed at this villa with Byron and Polidori, on and off, collectively, all of them, you could maybe call them the Geneva set. Just like you have the jet set, right? And if you don't already know who else this is, don't worry. I'm about to tell you. I just feel bad that John was overshadowed, and I want to make this more about him. So I'm kind of dragging it out, okay? So I want to also, FYI, tell you that you can read John's diary. Just don't do what I did. I was all excited. I Googled while I was writing this down, you know, when I was first researching it. And I found it on Kindle on sale for $6.32, the whole edited and everything. I should have got the physical one if I was going to do it, because of course I did the one click and I'm like, I'm going to read this and see, you know, what I can find out, because this is probably what a lot of the story that I'm about to tell you, which there's actually even been movies about it and little documentaries and it's mentioned a lot. This is probably what it was based on. And then I realized, you know, that's going to be out of copyright. It's old enough. And sure enough, you can get it. You can read it for free. You're welcome. I'll put it in the show notes. It's Gutenberg.org, which is a place that I have actually found other things, but I didn't think of it. It's a very good resource for out of copyright materials. I've even gone here for pamphlets on exorcisms that were written down that I've shared with you. So, okay, but without further ado, who were these other guests? Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin and her intended Percy Bysshe Shelley. I don't know if that's how you say it, but that's how I'm going to say it. B-Y-S-S-H-E. I don't care. I think it suits him because you know who Mary is, by the way, right? She wrote Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus. That's who she is. And I, by the way, plug myself a little here, have done a podcast episode on that. It's actually more about the science behind it. And it's called She Blinded Me with Science. I invite you to go back through my episode list early on, maybe the first season, I don't remember for sure. But I thought it was pretty good. It's very interesting anyway. I know I learned some shit when I looked it up that I thought was really morbidly fascinating. And man, the people of those times were just into some crazy shit. But Percy himself is a bit famous. Well, he's very famous as far as he's also a writer. In fact, for a while, people thought that Percy must have written Frankenstein because no way that that woman, Mary, could have written it, especially when Percy was already established. And yeah, that's bullshit. She wrote it, okay? Let's get that straight. It's a wonderful example of science fiction, by the way. And if you haven't read it, it's not even that long. It's a couple hundred pages. And it's marvelous. And most of the movies have absolutely nothing in common with it. Nothing in common at all. For starters, Frankenstein's monster is actually extremely intelligent, which makes him scary. I wouldn't necessarily call it a horror novel per se, which it has been made into quite a bit, but I don't know. Go read it if you hadn't. Sorry, John. John Polidori, not trying to outshine you. The reason I say Percy was kind of, he was even trying to revive dead cats when he was like, I guess you would say, in college. These people all had something going on. So they also had Mary's stepsister, Claire Claremont, there. So that's five of them all together. Now, it's approximately 27 May when Percy Shelley is mentioned. All of them are mentioned. Byron meets up with him. They kind of travel in and out from what I gathered, because I read through a bit of the diary. I had started out trying to read you excerpts from the diary, but it's honestly, frankly, most of it is boring as hell. Like, it did not yield what I was hoping. I thought we were going to have this fabulous details about them challenging each other to write the stories, because that's true. There was some sort of challenge to each of them write their own ghost story. So if you've ever seen movies about that or seen it mentioned, especially around Halloween, you know, people like to bring stuff up. That's true. They did all say, like, all five of them, you know, we're each going to write a story. But honestly, there's like one mention where John says, started ghost story. And like, that's it. So I had to dig in other places. The diary also has moments where he's just kind of jotting down, had breakfast, went to dinner, got in a boat. And he meets the rest of them, Mary and Claire, approximately the 28th, I believe. He also, I can tell you, mistakenly thought that Mary and Claire were blood sisters, not just stepsisters. He used the same surname for them both for a minute, but he also refers to Mary as Mrs. Shelley. I didn't think they were married yet, but maybe they were presenting that way. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't Percy also leave a wife? Because I think there was a little scandal there as well. These guys were all over the place. Let's just say that. I'm pretty sure that when I looked that up before, that Percy also had run off. But there's some mention in the, there is a mention in the diary about somebody running off with an elope. Yes, eloping with Godwin, which would have been, I don't know, which would have been her surname somehow. I'm confused. It's a little confusing. And then at points in the diary, though, he'll bust out into a little more prose, you know, and gets more into it. Also, what I could kind of glean from some other notes is that there was a point where Byron had a confidential talk with Percy in Polidori's presence, you know, maybe before those dates I gave you. On May 28th, I can tell you that John Polidori had a fever that a doctor told him was just normal among travelers. And then, let me see. May 29th is about when he starts talking a lot about dining with them and going to breakfast with them practically every morning, or at least Percy. This goes on and on. There are points that he mentions that he's tired and has an ache. I don't mean like he's horny, like has a pain in his loins. I started to say an ache in his loins. There was then an incident where he strained his left ankle and was then also talking to Percy about one of his poems. And apparently Percy Shelley really liked one of John's poems, or plays, pardon me, a play. And the editor makes a note that it probably was the one called Cajetan, C-A-J-E-T-A-N. And then June 17th, I wanted to bring to your attention, because he was laid up with the ankle, right? And apparently the others had gone to, or were going to, a dance or a party. And this is when everyone else started their ghost stories but him. So that's the first time he even mentions it. There was apparently some party at Cologne. I don't know how far that is from the villa. In which Byron, Polidori, Percy, Mary, and Claire each decided to write a ghost story. I guess they challenged each other to it. I don't think it was a bet. But they, like, ah, I can write a story. Can you write a story? So he doesn't mention this, though, until June 17th. And then, as far as I can tell, he never mentioned it again. And I read through and read through. June 18th, he mentions that his leg is worse. The others are having a party in the villa. And that's when John starts his story. That's when he starts his story. And he just didn't really say anything else about it. Some other things in the diary that were sort of interesting is that it sounds like he had some fights with Byron. It also, at one point, he apparently threatened to shoot Percy. We don't know why. We don't know what they were fighting over. So there was a little drama. So I just think this was some dramatic people, you guys. And maybe even challenged him to a duel. But don't worry, it was resolved. And Polidori apologized. And I guess everybody made up. I don't know. There's later parts in the diary where he starts writing in full paragraphs again. And I really do invite you to read it and at least skim through parts of it, because those parts were kind of interesting, because then I think John's kind of off by himself and not really hanging out with Byron anymore. And he goes to parties and things, and he sounds like a little gutter snipe, you know. He's sort of taking notes and just throwing shade at people, and I'm kind of here for it, you know. He's just very straightforward in his opinions of people. And it's like he knew that someone else was going to read this. That's why I think I'm kind of here for it, because, you know, maybe I'll go to some of those excerpts. We'll see if I have time. I want to now just go to, though, the introduction by his nephew and read a little bit of this, the intro to this diary for you, because there was a lot of issue for Polidori when this story first came out. Oh, and by the way, I haven't said the story, have I? Well, it's The Vampire, or Vampire, V-A-M-P-Y-R-E. That's John's story. And I know I have it in one of my vampire collections. I know I have it. I should reread it. Maybe I'll do a podcast where I just read it to you sometime. I will start here with this introduction by Rossetti, and because there's some other things I want to tell you about John before we get into the story. A person whose name finds mention in the books about Byron, and to some extent in those about Shelley, was John William Polidori, M.D. He was Lord Byron's traveling physician in 1816, when his lordship quitted England soon after the separation from his wife. I, who now act as editor of his diary, am a nephew of his, born after his death. Dr. Polidori figures not very advantageously in books concerning Byron and Shelley. He is exhibited as overweening and petulant, too fond of putting himself forward face to face with those two heroes of our poetical literature, and too touchy when either of them decline to take him at his own estimation. I will allow that this judgment of Polidori is, so far as it goes, substantially just, and that some of the recorded anecdotes of him prove him deficient in self-knowledge, lacking prudence and reserve, and ignoring the distinction between a dignified and quarrelsome attitude of mind. He was, in fact, extremely young when he went abroad in April 1816 with Byron, to whom he had been recommended by Sir Henry Halford. He was then only 20 years of age, Byron being 28 and Shelley 23. The recommendation given to so very a young man is a little surprising. It would be a mistake, however, to suppose that Polidori was without some solid attainments and some considerable share of talent. He was the son of Gaetano Polidori, a Tuscan man of letters who, after being secretary to the celebrated dramatist Alfieri, had settled in London as a teacher of Italian, and of his English wife, a Miss Pierce, the parents, my maternal grandparents, survived to a great age, only dying in 1853. John Polidori, after receiving his education in the Roman Catholic College of Ampleforth, Yorkshire, studied medicine in Edinburgh and took his doctor's degree at a singularly early age, I believe almost unexampled, the age of 19. His ambition was fully as much for literary as for professional distinction, and he published, besides The Vampire, to which I shall have to recur, a prose tale named Ernestus Berchtold, a volume of verse containing a drama entitled Ximenes, and some other writings. One of these writings is the text to a volume published in 1821 entitled Sketches Illustrated of the Manner, of the Manners and Costumes of France, Switzerland, and Italy by R. Brigdens. The name of Polidori is not indeed recorded in this book, but I know as a certainty that he was the writer. Side note here from me, Sadly, this is a recurring theme. One of the designs in the volume shows the costume of women at Lyrisi just about the same time when Shelley was staying there in the closing months of his life, and a noticeable costume it was. Polidori himself, though I am not aware that he ever received any instruction in drawing worth speaking of, had some considerable native gift in sketching faces and figures with lifelike expression. I possess a few examples to prove as much. The diary shows that he took some serious and intelligent interest in works of art, as well as in literature, and he was clearly a rapid and somewhat caustic judge of character. And those are the ones I'm telling you about, by the way, where I'm like, you know, he sounds kind of catty. His nephew says, perhaps a correct one, in other words, and it was probably true. He was a fine, rather romantic-looking young man, as evidenced by his portrait in the National Portrait Gallery, accepted from me by that institution in 1895. Dr. Polidori's life was a short one. Not long after quitting Lord Byron in 1816, he returned to London, and in Norwich continued his medical career, but eventually relinquished this and began studying for the bar, so he's going to be a lawyer. It is said that Miss Harriet Martineau was rather in love with him in Norwich. In August 1821, he committed suicide with poison, having, through losses in gambling, incurred a debt of honor for which he had no present means of clearing off. That he did take poison, prussic acid, was a fact perfectly well known in his family. But it is curious to note that the easygoing and good-naturedly disposed coroner's jury were content to return a verdict without eliciting any distinct evidence as to the cause of his death, and they simply pronounced that he had died by the visitation of God. The matter was reported in two papers, The Traveler and The New Times. I possess a copy, made by my mother at the time, of the reports, and it may perhaps be as well inserted here. So here is the copy from The Traveler. Monday evening, August 27th, 1821. Melancholy event. Mr. Polidori, residing in Great Pulteney Street, retired to rest about his usual time on Thursday night. The servant, not finding him rise at the usual hour yesterday, went to his room between 11 and 12 o'clock and found him groaning and apparently in the last agonies of death. An alarm was given and medical aid was immediately called, but before the arrival of surgeons Copeland and Davies, he was no more. His father was at the time on his journey to London to see his son and arrived about 3 hours after the event. We understand the deceased was about 26 years of age and had for some time accompanied Lord Byron in Italy. A coroner's inquest will sit this day to ascertain the cause of his death. And now from the New Times. Tuesday, September 11th, 1821. Coroner's inquest on John Polidori, Esquire. An inquisition has been taken before T. Higgs, Esquire, Deputy Coroner, at the residence of the father of the above unfortunate gentleman, in Great Pulteney Street, Golden Square, who was discovered lying on his bed in a state nearly approaching to death, and soon afterwards expired. Charlotte Reed, the servant to Mr. Gaetano Polidori, the father of deceased, said her master's son lived in the house and for some time had been indisposed. On Monday, 20th of August, he last returned from Brighton since, which his conduct manifested strong symptoms of incoherence, and he gave his order for dinner in a very strange manner. On the Thursday following, the deceased dined with a gentleman residing in the same house, and on that occasion he appeared very much depressed in his spirits. About 9 o'clock the same evening, he ordered witness to leave a glass tumbler in his room. This was unusual, but one was placed as he desired. Deceased told her he was unwell. If, therefore, he did not get up by 12 o'clock the next day, do not disturb him. She, however, a few minutes before 12, went into his room to open the shutters, and on her return saw the deceased lying in bed. He was not in any unusual position, but seemed extremely ill. She immediately left the room, went upstairs, and communicated what she had observed to a gentleman who instantly came down. She then went for medical assistance. The deceased was about 26 years of age. Mr. John D'Agostini, the gentleman alluded to by the witness, corroborated her statement on his giving him the invitation to dine, which he accepted in a way quite different from his usual conduct. The witness also observed that, sometime since, the deceased had met with an accident, was thrown out of his gig and seriously hurt in the head. On Thursday at dinner, he spoke in half sentences. The conversation was on politics and a future state. The deceased had observed rather harshly that the witness would see more than him. He appeared to be deranged in his mind, and his countenance was haggard. At dinner, he had ate very little, soon after left the room, but joined again at tea, hardly spoke a word, and retired at 9 o'clock. After breakfast next morning, witness inquired of the servant whether Polidori had gone out. She replied no, and that he had desired her not to disturb him. About 12 o'clock, the servant came to him very much alarmed. Witness went immediately to the apartment of the deceased and observed a tumbler on the chair, which contained nothing but water, and did not perceive any deleterious substance that the deceased might have taken. He was senseless and apparently in a dying state. Mr. Thomas Copeland, a surgeon residing in Golden Square, was sent for suddenly to attend the deceased and attempted to discharge the contents of the stomach without effect. He lingered for about 10 minutes and expired. Another medical gentleman soon after arrived, but his assistance was also unavailing. There being no further evidence adduced to prove how the deceased came to his death, the jury, under these circumstances, returned a verdict of died by the visitation of God. An interesting other note here is that someone named Medwin, wrote a book called Conversations with Lord Byron, gives the following account of how Byron received the news of Dr. Polidori's death. Quote, "I was convinced," said Byron, "something very unpleasant hung over me last night. I expected to hear that somebody I knew was dead. So it turns out, poor Polidori is gone. When he was my physician, he was always talking of prussic acid, oil of amber, blowing into veins, suffocating by charcoal, and compounding poisons, but for a different purpose to what the Pontic monarch did, for he has prescribed a dose for himself that would have killed 50 Mithridates, a dose whose effect, Murray says, was so instantaneous that he went off without a spasm or struggle. It seems that disappointment was the cause of this rash act." So the evidence of the servant at the inquest shows the death did not come so very suddenly, and in my own family I have always heard the poison spoken of as simply prussic acid. That's a quote from Rossetti. So that's really sad. That's really sad. You know, he goes from being such a bright, incredibly young student, you know, doctor at a very young age. He's going to study the bar. He got to travel with Lord Byron, who was infamous and famous. He got paid to write about it. And it's just really sad. But he's also disrespected quite often. Some people spoke of Polidori later as a physician and secretary to Lord Byron, which is not true. I mean, he was paid for the diary. Didn't make him a secretary. And Byron is not the one who paid him. Then you have what happens with the vampire. When it came out, the credit was given to Lord Byron. And I'm going to read to you now a couple of letters by John Polidori. The first one is to Henry Colburn, London, April 2nd, 1819. "Sir," and Colburn, by the way, is a publisher, "I received a copy of the magazine last April, the present month, and am sorry to find that your Genevan correspondent has led you into a mistake with regard to the tale of the vampire, which is not Lord Byron's, but was written entirely by me at the request of a lady who, upon my mentioning that his lordship had said that it was his intention of writing a ghost story, depending for interest upon the circumstances of two friends leaving England and one dying in Greece, the other finding him alive upon his return and making love to his sister, in parenthetical, saying that she thought it impossible to work up such materials, desired that I would write it for her, which I did in two idle mornings by her side. The circumstances above mentioned, and the one of the dying man having obtained an oath that the survivor should not in any way disclose his decease, are the only parts of the tale belonging to his lordship. I desire, therefore, that you will positively contradict your statement in the next number by the insertion of this note. With regard to my own tale, it is imperfect and unfinished. I had rather, therefore, it should not appear in the magazine, and, if the editor had sent his communication, as he mentions, he would have been spared this mistake. But, sir, there is one circumstance of which I must request a further explanation. I observe upon the back of your publication the announcement of a separate edition, Now, upon buying this, I find that it states in the title page that it was entered into Stationer's Hall upon March 27, consequently before your magazine was published. I wish, therefore, to ask for information how this tale passed from the hands of your editor into those of a publisher. As it is a mere trifle, I should have had no objection to its appearing in your magazine, as I could, in common with any other, have extracted it thence and republished it. But I shall not sit patiently by and see it taken without my consent and appropriated by any person. As, therefore, it must have passed through your hands, as stated in the magazine, from a correspondent, I shall expect that you will account to me for the publishers, Messrs. Sherwood and Neely, having possession of it and appropriating it to themselves, and demand either that a compensation be made me or that its separate publication be instantly suppressed. Hoping for an immediate answer, which will save me the trouble of obtaining an injunction, I remain, sir, your obedient servant, John Polidori. So he's a little spicy there, even though it's very polite language. The stress that I gave to it is there in italics, at least in this writing. You will see when I get to, I'm going to give you the plot and such of The Vampire, you know, spoiler alert for later, and you'll understand a little more what that parenthetical was about the ghost and the making. And by the way, in that time, making love would mean romancing, not the actual physical act. Although I must admit, at first I was like, a ghost is making... Yeah. I also, what I get from that, I think gives me a little more idea of their challenge of writing the ghost stories. So it sounds like it was Lord Byron's idea. I think that's how it's depicted in one of the movies I've seen as well. It sounds like it was Lord Byron's idea that, like, oh, I bet, you know, you could write a story about this, this, and this. Okay, let's all write stories. And I'm thinking that the woman who is never named that he says he wrote it for would be Claire Claremont, Mary Shelley's stepsister, because Claire, I can tell you, never came up with anything. She got bupkis out of her stay. She did not write a story. Lord Byron also came up with bupkis, factually, even though this was attributed to him. He didn't really write anything. Percy Shelley, there's really nothing known about what he wrote. They say he probably wrote something, but apparently it's not noteworthy at all. The only two big things to come out of that, well, I want to say weekend. I don't know if it was a weekend, because here you see that he says a couple of nights in her presence. The next letter I'm going to read to you, it says three nights. And I guess that would account for why, when I was reading through the diary, I was like, this is barely even mentioned. Well, that's why. He whipped it up like that. That and Frankenstein are the only things to come out of this. So carrying on to the editor of the Morning Chronicle. Sir, as you were the first person to whom I wrote to state that the tale of the vampire was not Lord Byron's, I beg you to insert the following statement in your paper. The tale, as I stated to you in my letter, was written upon the foundation of a proposed and begun story of Lord Byron's. Lord Byron, in a letter dated Venice, stated that he knew nothing of the vampire story. So Byron's backing him up, okay? And hated vampires. But while this letter was busily circulating in all the London and provincial papers, the fragment at the end of Mazeppa, I don't know what that is, y'all, sorry, was in the hands of his publishers in Albemarle Street, with the date of June 17, 1816, attached to it. Okay, I'm going to break in for a moment. So something else that Byron wrote called Mazeppa, I assume, the tiny fragment maybe for the idea of the vampire was in it. I think that's what I'm getting from that. So yes, June 17, 1816, attached to it, being the beginning of his tale upon this very foundation. So I think I'm right about that. My development was written on the continent and left with a lady at whose request it was undertaken. In the course of three mornings by her side, it was produced and left with her. So if it is Claire, she's the Genevan correspondent that was mentioned in the other, and she was sent the one who sent it. Or it's some other woman, because there was other people around, so I can't really verify that. There were other people around. I'm just guessing on that. From her hands, by means of a correspondent without my knowledge, it came into those of the editor of the New Monthly, with a letter stating it to be an ébauche of Lord Byron's. Mr. Watts, as editor of that magazine, stated in his notice that the tale which accompanies the letters, quote, we also present to our readers without pledging ourselves for its authenticity as the production of Lord Byron. So they didn't verify it at first. And he continues, we should suppose it to have been committed to paper rather from recital of a third person. This, however, after the publication of 700 copies, was cancelled by the publisher, and another notice inserted stating it to be decidedly his lordship's, in direct opposition, as I am informed, to the editor's will, who has since retired from the conduct of the magazine. Immediately it was published, I procured a copy, and, upon finding that it was an almost forgotten trifle of my own, I instantly wrote to you as editor of the Morning Chronicle, stating that the little share Lord Byron had in the work. This was upon the Friday evening after its publication. I at the same time wrote to the publishers of the tale in its separate form, and to those of the magazine, to stop its sale under his lordship's name. On Monday, the publishers of the magazine called upon me and promised it should be instantly announced as mine. When I came to claim my share of the profits, I was offered £30 instead of nearly 300. Your obedient servant, John Polidori. Now, there is then a note by his nephew here that there was a prefatory note to the Vampire in the New Monthly magazine that says, we received several private letters in the course of last autumn from a friend traveling on the continent, and among others the following, which we give to the public on account of its containing anecdotes of an individual concerning whom the most trifling circumstances, if they tend to mark even the minor features of his mind, cannot fail of being considered important and valuable by those who know how to appreciate his erratic but transcendent genius. The tale which accompanied the letter, we have also much pleasure in presenting to our readers. Editor. And then there's a final note. We have in our possession the tale of Dr. Now this is just blank, but that would be Polidori, I assume, as well as the outline of that of Miss Godwin, which of course would be Frankenstein. The latter has already appeared under the title of Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. The former, however, upon consulting with its author, we may probably hereafter give to our readers. And the editor here, his nephew, Rossetti, questions whether or not the editor actually even wrote the prefatory note, or did the publisher Colburn write it? Are these things even true? Because Polidori seems to dispute that. I read that to you because I want you to know that it, more than once, somebody else was getting credit for his stuff. Furthermore, something like The Vampire, which ended up being a really big deal. I want to say that it reminds me of, like, okay, if I ask people, you know, who directed The Nightmare Before Christmas? I bet a bunch of you out there just said Tim Burton. No, it's Henry Selick. And it happens a lot more than you know, and I bet it happened an awful lot back then. I'm sure there's a lot of things that are still attributed to the wrong people to this day. But on the one hand, Lord Byron's name attached to it might have given it that push of publicity. But on the other, even when you finally say who the actual author was, a lot of people are then going to argue like, no, it's probably Lord Byron, which until people look it up, when I tell them that Tim Burton did not direct that movie, they don't believe me either until they look it up. And so I feel really bad. I feel really bad for him. Now, what is the tale itself? Well, it's a short work of prose fiction, and it is often listed as part of a contest between them all to write these. It is viewed as the progenitor of the romantic vampire genre of fantasy fiction. Someone has described it as the first story successfully to fuse the disparate elements of vampirism into a coherent literary genre. The plot. and now the other weird thing will make sense to you, hopefully, if you remember what I even said. There's someone named Aubrey, meets the mysterious Lord Ruthven at a social event when he comes to London. After briefly getting to know Ruthven, Aubrey agrees to go traveling around Europe with him. Sound familiar? But leaves him shortly after they reach Rome when he learns that Ruthven seduced the daughter of a mutual acquaintance. And we already know that Lord Byron was a cad, so maybe he was taken from some real life there. Now alone, Aubrey travels to Greece where he falls in love with an innkeeper's daughter, Ianthe. She tells him about the legends of the vampire, which are very popular in the area. So their romance is short-lived because she is unfortunately killed and found with her throat torn open. The whole town believes it to be the work of the evil vampire, but Aubrey doesn't put two and two together that this coincidentally happened shortly after Lord Ruthven came back into the area. They actually kiss and make up as friends. Yo, let's travel again. Okay, it's cool. It's cool. We're just dudes. It's cool. He rejoins him in his travels, which is unfortunately the beginning of the end. They are attacked by bandits on a road, and Ruthven is mortally wounded. On his deathbed, he makes Aubrey swear an oath that he will not speak with Ruthven or his death for a year and a day. And once Aubrey agrees, Lord Ruthven literally dies laughing. For real. Then Aubrey returns to London, and he is amazed when none other than Ruthven appears shortly thereafter, alive and well, but under a new identity. Ruthven reminds Aubrey of his oath and then begins to seduce Aubrey's sister. Now he's helpless to protect his sister, and he has a nervous breakdown. Once he recovers, Aubrey learns that Ruthven is engaged to his sister, and they are due to be married on the very day that his oath will end. So he writes a letter to his sister explaining everything, just in case something happens to him before he can warn her in person. And what do you suppose happened? Of course he dies. And the letter does not arrive in time. Ruthven marries Aubrey's sister, kills her on their wedding night. How romantic. And she's found drained of blood, with Ruthven long gone into the night. Bleh, bleh. And now I told you the whole story, but you should really go read it for all the details. With the usual pictures, there's some clippings that I want to share. There's a little clipping here of its publication in the New Monthly magazine when it was attributed to Lord Byron. And another reason that people believed that it was him is that the protagonist, Lord Ruthven, was a name that was used by Lady Caroline Lamb in a novel called Glenarvan, which was actually from the same publisher. And it's a thinly disguised Lord Byron figure who was named Clarence de Ruthven, Earl of Glenarvan. So even though Byron and Polidori denied that Byron had written it, it often was just unclarified, and people just either assumed it was Byron or it was stated that it was. Then, of course, you had Polidori. I told you the letters that he started to write. It was first published in book form by the people he mentioned, Sherwood, Neely, and Jones, in London, Paternoster Row, 1819, as The Vampire, A Tale, and it's 84 pages. On the cover, the notation was entered at Stationer's Hall, March 27, 1819. And again, it was given as Lord Byron. Later printings, they did eventually remove Byron's name and put Polidori's on the page. But, you know, like I said a little bit ago, the damage was done. It was good in some respects because, yes, the Byron name, and it was popular. But also because it exploited the Gothic horror predilections of the public at the time. They were into it. You get up into the Victorian times, we get that spiritualism, occultism. And again, I invite you to listen to the episode She Blinded Me with Science, because people would go and attend events where they thought they were going to bring a dead convict back to life with electricity. Go listen to it. That was not completely made up, okay? And they would go, you know, they'd go to seances. It was just no big deal. That's what everybody did. If somebody tried to invite you to a party now where they were going to electrocute a dead guy to make him move, they would be arrested. I just love that era in time. It's fascinating. I don't remember now if I mentioned in the beginning that a lot of the stories talk about them doing this whole, you know, they show Lord Byron. I think the one I saw, it was Gabriel Byrne who played him. They show Lord Byron and all of them in, you know, the villa, and it's thundering and lightning, and it, you know, of course it sets a wonderful, wonderful scene for that. It is apparently true that in 1816, the year without a summer, was when Europe and parts of North America underwent a severe climate abnormality. There was apparently incessant rain and a wet, ungenial summer over 3 days in June. And that is when they started telling each other their fantastical tales and writing their own. I don't think I saw that when I was skimming through the diary, but it was just during a few days. I don't know. I have to go back and look at it again. And they were fueled, these ghost stories were fueled by things like Phantasmagoriana, William Beckford's Vathek, and quantities of laudanum. Yeah, that checks out. Maybe that's why he threatened to shoot Percy one time. He'd taken too much laudanum. Which, perhaps not coincidentally, I guess it's not in his story, but I suddenly just thought, like, you know, laudanum does turn up in some vampire tales. I used it myself recently. That's right, I used Dark Wings. Go check it out. My book. My latest. That's right. This little bit that was supposedly from Byron's idea, a fragmentary story, fragment of a novel, also known as A Fragment and The Burial of Fragment. So, whatever, right? By the way, side note, you cannot copyright an idea. So if you're out there on the fence, like, well, maybe it should have been Byron's, that was shitty. Maybe it's not Byron's because Polidori actually really wrote it. Yeah, you cannot copyright ideas, okay? That's why a lot of authors, writers, won't tell people their idea because they don't want somebody to take it and write it before they can. So if you ever ask a writer, what are you working on now and what it's about, and they don't really want to tell you, well, don't take it personally. They just don't want anybody to take their idea and run with it. And believe me, it's happened. It's happened to people. But you cannot do that. You can copyright the book, the story, the short story, the whatever, but you can't just go up and say, hey, that was my idea. Well, where's your story? Well, I didn't write it. Well, then, tough shit. That's just the way it is. Now, as far as Polidori's influence, you know, how the vampire has influenced things, there's been numerous editions and translations, and it extends into our current era and is considered canon in many ways, along with Bram Stoker's Dracula, and is often cited as almost folkloric sources on vampirism. There's an adaptation that appeared in 1820 with Cyprien Berard's novel Lord Ruthven ou les Vampires, which is falsely attributed to Charles Nodier, who himself then wrote his own dramatic version, Le Vampire, a play which had enormous success and sparked a vampire craze across Europe, which includes, by the way, operatic adaptations by Heinrich Marschner, Der Vampir, and Peter Josef von Lindpartner, Der Vampir, which are both published the same year. I guess they have the same title. I don't know. There's Nikolai Gogol, which sounds very familiar to me and made me think of those, the horror plays theater, the Grand Guignol. I know it's different. I don't think I'm saying it right, but it makes me think I should do an episode on that, by the way. Are you for that? Let me know. Twitter at PodPinky. I'll probably do it anyway. Here's one I didn't know, that Alexandre Dumas, Père Dumas, who of course Three Musketeers, Count of Monte Cristo, all that, produced their own vampire tales. I need to look up that now. Alexei Tolstoy did. And themes from Polidori's tale continue to influence Bram Stoker's Dracula and the entire vampire genre. Dumas makes explicit reference to Lord Ruthven in The Count of Monte Cristo, going so far as to state that his character, the Comtesse G, had been personally acquainted with Lord Ruthven. Kim Newman's Anno Dracula series, which I know I have the first one around here and had started to read and got sidetracked. Lord Ruthven is a prominent character in the Anno Dracula universe. He becomes a figure in British politics following the ascent of Dracula to power. I won't say any more in case you haven't read it. I won't spoil it. There's an 1819 tale, The Black Vampire, an American novella by Uriah Darcy, published it was taking advantage of the vampire's popularity. In 2016, it was announced that the studio Britannia Pictures would be releasing a feature-length adaptation of The Vampire, produced for the film, I haven't even had laudanum, and here we go. Production for the film was slated to begin in late 2018, with filming taking place in the UK, Italy, and Greece. The film would be directed by Rowan M. Ashe, was scheduled for release in October 2019. This makes it sound like it didn't come out. I would have to check on that. Earlier adaptations of Polidori's story include the 1945 film The Vampire's Ghost, starring John Abbott as your Lord Ruthven character, who is actually Webb Fallon. The setting was changed from England and Greece to Africa. There's also The Vampire, a soap opera, which is based on the opera De Vampire. And that was based on the Polidori story. It was filmed and broadcast on BBC Two December 2nd, 1992. Lord Ruthven's character was named Ripley. He was frozen in the late 18th century, but revives in modern times and becomes a successful businessman. There was also in England, James Planchet's play, The Vampire or The Bride of the Isles, was first performed in London in 1820 at the Lyceum Theatre. It was based on Charles Nodier's Le Vampire, which of course was based on Polidori's. Melodramas were satirized like Ritigore by Gilbert and Sullivan in 1887. There's a character called Sir Ruthven who must abduct a maiden or he will die. In 1988, American playwright Tim Kelly created a drawing room adaptation of The Vampire, Vampire, however you want to say it, for the stage, popular among community theaters and high school drama clubs. And another side note, the thing that said that he must abduct a maiden or die suddenly made me think of, there's a movie called Blood for Dracula, which stars the fabulous Udo Kier, who's actually played vampires many times. He was even in Blade. There's also Flesh for Frankenstein. They were two that he filmed in Italy when he was very young. He looks like Rudolph Valentino or something. He's just gorgeous. And they did them in just a few weeks. And they're very campy. Just so campy. While at the same time sort of pretending to be high art. You have to see it to believe it. But the Dracula one, it made me think of it because in that he has to have the blood of a virgin. And that's why he's hanging out at this one villa with these three girls there that the father swears are virgins, you know, and he thinks he's some count or some rich guy or, you know, that he can marry them. When he drinks the blood of one and it turns out she's not actually a virgin, there's just an extended blood puking scene that is just ridiculous. And you're laughing and then you're like, okay, enough. And he stops for a second and then it starts all over again. And oh my God, yeah, I have that DVD. Look it up and look it up if you're curious. Blood for Dracula. Also, he's sort of a wimpy character and it's really Renfield that's just an asshole and bosses him around. It's a very different take than anything you've ever seen, I promise you, if you're interested. And that, my friends, is John Polidori, author of The Vampire. And it was not written by Lord Byron, and he needs to have credit where credit is due. And thus I did an episode. Also, if you want to read The Vampire, you can read it for free. I will also put that link in the show notes. There's a nice little page here that not only has the actual story itself, it's got a lot of other things besides John Polidori, but there's extract of a letter from Geneva. So I'll probably link this page so you can follow any of these links. There's an introduction, you know, regarding the history and facts of the vampire, so it says. There's an extract of a letter containing an account of Lord Byron's residence in the island of Mytilene, which that's a trip to Greece. And I don't know what that part is about. I want to read you a little something, though. Also, by the way, they have these apparently narrated or something because I see audio, so you could listen to them. I am probably not the best at this type of poetry reading because I'm not quite familiar. It's been a long time with the beat of it, so please forgive me. But I wanted to read you just a little something that Polidori wrote that is not vampire fiction. The sky has changed, and such a change. Oh, night and storm and darkness, ye are wondrous strong, yet lovely in your strength, as is the light of a dark eye and woman far along. From peak to peak the rattling crags among leaps the lyre thunder. Not from one lone cloud, but every mountain now hath found a tongue. And Jura answers, throw her misty shroud back to the joyous Alps, who call to her aloud. And this is in the night, most glorious night. Thou wert not sent for slumber. Let me be a sharer in thy far and fierce delight, a portion of the tempest in me. How the lit lake shines, a phosphoric sea, and the big rain comet dancing to the earth. And now again 'tis black, and now the glee of the loud hill shakes with its mountain mirth, as if they did rejoice o'er a young earthquake's birth. Now where the swift Rhine cleaves his way between heights which appear as lovers who have parted in haste, whose mining depths so intervene that they can meet no more, though broken-hearted, though in their souls with thus each other thwarted. Love was the very root of fond rage, which blighted their life's bloom and then departed, itself expired, but leaving them an age of years all winter, war within themselves to wage. So that is one of just a little something that he actually just put in a letter, extract of a letter from Geneva. And I would assume that then this would be maybe around when he was staying in the villa. And there you have it. I was going to wrap up. Should I give you just a little? I'm looking at the text now for the vampire.
It happened that in the midst of the dissipations attendant upon a London winter, there appeared at the various parties of the leaders of the ton a nobleman, more remarkable for his singularities than his rank. He gazed upon the mirth around him as if he could not participate therein. Apparently, the light laughter of the fair only attracted his attention so that he might by a look quell it and throw fear into those breasts where thoughtlessness reigned. Those who felt this sensation of awe could not explain whence it arose. Some attributed it to the dead gray eye, which, fixing upon the object's face, did not seem to penetrate, and at one glance to pierce through to the inward workings of the heart, but fell upon the cheek with a leaden ray that weighed upon the skin it could not pass. His peculiarities caused him to be invited to every house. All wished to see him, and those who had been accustomed to violent excitement and now felt the weight of ennui were pleased at having something in their presence capable of engaging their attention. In spite of the deadly hue of his face, which never gained a warmer tint, either from the blush of modesty or from the strong emotion of passion, though its form and outline were beautiful, many of the female hunters after notoriety attempted to win his attentions and gain, at least, some marks of what they might term affection. Lady Mercer, who had been the mockery of every monster shoon in drawing rooms since her marriage, threw herself in his way and did all but put on the dress of a mountebank to attract his notice, though in vain. When she stood before him, though his eyes were apparently fixed upon hers, still it seemed as if they were unperceived. Even her unappalled impudence was baffled, and she left the field. But though the common adulteress could not influence even the guidance of his eyes, it was not that the female sex was indifferent to him, yet such was the apparent caution with which he spoke to the virtuous wife and innocent daughter that few knew he ever addressed himself to females. He had, however, the reputation of a winning tongue, and whether it was that it even overcame the dread of his singular character, or that they were moved by his apparent hatred of vice, he was as often among those females who form the boast of their sex from their domestic virtues as among those who sully it by their vices. And there you have the opening to The Vampire or The Vampire. I would guess that because he was British raised, it's probably vampire. But it's interesting that it's spelled with a Y. Of course, there are etymologies, not the study of bugs, pardon me, etymologies that will cover the origin of the words vampire, 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 etc. I'm guessing he probably pronounced it the vampire. But I just prefer vampire, like the movie. And there you have it, the episode of Jean Polidori, the father of the vampire genre that I know I'm extremely grateful for, and I know a lot of you listening are as well. And furthermore, a sad tale that I felt needed to be put back out there. It's not as if he's never discussed, but in the documentaries, well, I guess they wouldn't even be full documentaries. They're not documentaries about him personally that I've seen. Whenever he's mentioned in the things that I've seen on television, it's always in conjunction with Lord Byron, Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, everybody at the villa, the villa. I've lost it. The villa, with some beautiful Italian name. And he is kind of shoved off to the side quite often, although they might mention that he wrote The Vampire, but he just doesn't get the same attention, and I don't think he gets his due, you know, because Byron was so flamboyant and this and that and the other, and of course he was a very great writer of other things, and Frankenstein, which should be lauded as an amazing work of fiction, it just steals the spotlight. Anyway, I wanted to try to give him his own episode. I couldn't do it without mentioning those people at least a little bit, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will look further into him and other things about his life, which was sadly so short, and, you know, that he committed suicide. I don't think I've heard that mentioned, or I forgot, but the coroners, though, as I read to you earlier on in the episode, kind of refused to say that that's what he did. So maybe it wasn't widely known for a while. But I don't feel like I really heard that in the mentions of him. So now you know, and it's very sad. But he lives on with proper attribution now for The Vampire. And I will link these websites so you can read them for free, his diary and The Vampire, 100% free. And there's nothing, there's no pirating here because they're out of copyright. So it's perfectly fine to do that. Thank you for listening. And I think I'm going to cook up something really cool and also old-timey, a little bit old-timey for next week. I don't think I'll say what it is yet in case I change my mind because, you know, I can be capricious, just like one of my characters. And if you know, you know. Please check out my new book, Dark Wings, which does have a vampire in it, by the way. Find me at pinkyswearpress.com for all the news, the podcasts, my blog, what I'm up to, you know, photographs, all the things that I do. Find me on Twitter at podpinky, Instagram pinky_podcast, Facebook pinkyswearpress, and I think that's it. And thanks so much for listening. Poo-poo-poo-pow, until next week. And I think we're going to do something that involves horror. Bye-bye.